The following is a rebroadcast of Studio Tulsa. This program first aired last year.
Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we hear about the Nile. There's always been an air of mystique about this ancient stream that has witnessed countless civilizations' beginnings and endings, from the very first Egyptian culture to the Arab Spring of just several years ago. Writers, too, have been fascinated, from Herodotus in Greek times to Agatha Christie, to my guest today as well. Toby Wilkinson is a renowned Egyptologist. He is the author of The Rise and Fall of Ancient Egypt, which won the Penn Award for Best Nonfiction Work of History in 2011, was named one of the best books of the year by the Washington Post and Publishers Weekly. He's currently a member of the International Editorial Board of the Journal of Egyptian History, and he's a fellow at Clare College in Cambridge. His latest book is a combined travelogue, an overview of ancient Egyptian culture, in his book The Nile, A Journey Downriver Through Egypt's Past and Present, which reminds us that Egyptian civilization and the waters of the Nile have always been intertwined. In the book, he takes us down from the Aswan Dams, where the quarries for the pyramids and obelisks were found, past Luxor, Thebes, the Valley of the Kings, and finally up to Cairo itself, in a short history of Egyptian culture and civilization. Toby Wilkinson joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Toby Wilkinson, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be on the show. Thank you.
I was struck by something I was either reading or spoke with another person familiar with Egypt who said, you know, the wonderful thing about Egypt is it doesn't matter if it's the Persians, it's the Greeks, the Romans, the Muslim world that came into Egypt, or the British later. Somehow all these cultures overtake Egypt, but their culture ends up becoming Egyptian. And I wonder if that's one of the interesting things at the heart of Egypt.
I think that's right. I think Egypt has a special attraction. There's something kind of magical and very alluring about Egyptian culture, about Egyptian civilization, even about the geography of Egypt itself with the River Nile. And as you say, everybody who has attempted to conquer Egypt has actually been conquered by Egypt in some sense. And I think that still continues today. I mean, we see how incredibly popular it remains with tourists and in the Western imagination generally. I mean, whether it's Hollywood movies about mummies or art and design, Egypt figures quite largely in a lot of our culture here in the West as well.
Now, your last book was about the rise and fall of ancient Egypt, but this book is a little different because it's sort of a bit of a travelogue in a way, yet it's telling a lot of the history of the archaeological sites and this sort of juxtaposition between the very ancient and the contemporary that you do as you travel down the Nile.
Well, that's right, and it's, I think one of the things that strikes any visitor to Egypt is not only how present the past is all around you, but how the different layers of Egyptian history kind of weave in and out of each other. And it's that constant intermingling of past and present which I think makes the country so fascinating. And I wanted to give a sense in the book of that, but also of a journey down the Nile, which of course is the silver thread that runs through Egyptian history through every era, and get a sense of how not only people and places and events have shaped Egypt, but have been shaped by their experience of Egypt too.
How important to the creation, the whole civilization, is this river? Because you move just a few hundred meters beyond the river, and it's two completely different places, isn't it, in many places along the river?
That's right. I mean, 2,500 years ago, a Greek historian called Herodotus famously described Egypt as the gift of the river. And it's absolutely true. Without the Nile, there would be no Egypt. There would only be Sahara Desert. So the river brings life to what otherwise would be a lifeless wilderness. And it makes it possible to have a great culture in that part of Africa. It's only the presence of water and the fertility that gives to the soil and the ability to grow crops and to create a bountiful economy that has made Egypt possible. So, yeah, Egypt is the Nile. The Nile is Egypt. The two are really inseparable.
In telling the story of the Nile, you really only tell the Egyptian story of the Nile. Why did you focus on that particularly?
Well, that's true. I mean, I am a specialist on Egyptian history, and you're absolutely right, of course. The Nile is a very long river. It's the longest river in Africa, and it rises way to the south of Egypt in the hills of Ethiopia and in the Great Lakes of Central Africa. But I think there's something particularly special about the Egyptian Nile. It's the river both at its most peaceful, in that it's, you know, by the time it reaches Egypt, it's crossed all of its rapids, fallen over all of its waterfalls, and it emerges into Egypt as this rather placid, broad, slow-flowing river. And yet, at the same time, it has this remarkable ability, and has had throughout history, to give and to take away. And I suppose it's also true that nowhere else along the Nile's banks has such an extraordinary story been played out as in Egypt. You know, for the last 5,000 years, there has been a civilization on the banks of the Egyptian Nile. And so it's particularly rich in history.
Now, what made you decide to write about the Nile?
Well, I've been traveling to Egypt for over 25 years now, and you know, the Nile is the common thread. But in particular, it was two trips that I made down the Nile just a few years ago. Curiously, it might seem, for somebody who goes to Egypt a lot, I'd never actually been on a boat down the Nile until about 4 or 5 years ago. I'd crisscrossed the Nile a lot. And it was that river journey that really brought home to me that actually the Nile is the essential viewpoint from which to see all the different periods of Egyptian history, all the characters, all the places. And it just forms the best possible kind of narrative thread for a book.
Now, the story begins in Aswan, where there was the Low Dam built by British colonists in the late 1800s. And, of course, that's been built up. And then the High Dam, which was a Cold War legacy in the 50s. This marks the beginning of the Nile in Egypt.
That's right. Aswan is an interesting city. It was really from the very beginning of Egyptian history, 5,000 years ago, regarded as the frontier. It was where Egypt began. And it's retained that sort of frontier mentality. And, of course, it's not just where Egypt begins, but it's also in Egyptian mythology where the Nile has its source. Now, of course, we know these days that the Nile rises a long way further south, but the ancient Egyptians believed it welled up from a cavern beneath the ground at Aswan. And that's because it's at Aswan that you first detect the annual, what we call the inundation, the flooding of the Nile, which was caused by summer rains, and they swelled the river. And it was when the river reached Aswan that it started to kind of burst its banks and bring fertility and water to the soil. Now, of course, the unintended consequence of building the Aswan dams, the old one and the high one, was that it stopped the inundation. That, in turn, stopped a lot of the source of Egypt's fertility. And so, although it has created more irrigated land, and it's generating power through hydroelectricity, it's not been an unmitigated success. And there are many effects of the dam, whether it's build-up of salts in the soil, whether it's the reliance on pesticides and chemical fertilizers, that have had actually quite a damaging effect on Egypt in the last 50 years or so.
I was really interested to read the section about how there's a cataract right at Aswan. It's the last major cataract on the Nile, and the whole sound of it gave Egyptians a sense, as well as the river levels, whether they could expect famine or flood or fertility. And even from the culture's earliest days, that measurement was something they went about doing as a yearly tradition to know what was going to happen for their
future.
That's
right. I mean, the height of the Nile at its flood would absolutely determine the success of the harvest and the amount of the harvest. And so the height of the flood became the single most important economic data point, if you like, in Egypt, because it would predict pretty accurately how successful the crops would be the following season, and therefore whether there would be feast or famine. I mean, we hear, of course, of the biblical story of the seven fat years and the seven lean years. Well, that was a reality for Egyptians. You know, if the Nile flood was too high or too low, then famine would surely ensue. So measuring that height was an absolutely critical fact in keeping the Egyptian economy going.
The Nile has been traveled for, gosh, millennia. And you document how that has changed over the years. But the fact is, as you can see, centuries-old ways of traveling the Nile right next to the most modern version today.
That's right. I mean, I think there's still a special romance in traveling the Nile by sailing boat, whether it's a felucca, which is the classic Egyptian sailing boat, or whether it's one of these wonderful houseboats that people in the Gilded Age used to travel up and down the Nile. But there's a great romance about that, because you're going at the pace of the river. You're seeing things in a very unhurried way. But, of course, for many tourists, the experience is of a big pleasure cruiser with floor-to-ceiling windows, and that's also a pretty dramatic way of seeing the scenery. I think what's interesting is that although Egypt is rapidly modernizing and it has a rail network and of course, roads, an awful lot of traffic still travels by river. You will see boats carrying stones from quarries to building sites, carrying grain from the fields to processing plants, carrying people, carrying livestock. So the river still remains, if you like, the most important artery for the whole of Egypt.
Now, you know, I always would think that the civilization began somewhere around Cairo, because Cairo is the eternal city of this culture. But in fact, Egyptian culture began very near Aswan in what you call the Deep South or Lower Egypt.
That's right. And it's interesting to understand why that is. And I think it's because in the south of Egypt, the river valley is very narrow, which means that it doesn't require too much effort to divide the floodplain into natural irrigation basins. It's the sort of thing that a small community can do quite easily to control the river across the stretch of valley. And it was there that agriculture first took root, and of course with agriculture come settled communities. And so that's where civilization really had its origin, where the river was easiest to control. And once again, it demonstrates this fact that the Nile has given life to Egypt in countless ways.
Now, usually probably most travelers never go further up the Nile than, say, Luxor or Thebes or something like that. But you actually begin this again back at the Aswan Dam, and there were important sites that were obliterated by the lakes created by those dams, and also right at the very beginning of the Nile. In fact, you tell this story of, it's actually very instructive of how Egyptians constructed these incredible obelisks that you will see further downriver.
Mm.
You tell the story of this obelisk that never was finished.
That's right. It's the most extraordinary monument, as you say, that was never finished. It still lies there in the granite quarries of Aswan. And what makes it remarkable were a number of things. First of all, if it had been finished, it would have been the biggest obelisk anywhere in Egypt. It's truly huge in scale. But even more interesting than that, because the workmen just downed their tools when they discovered a crack in the rock, it gives us a much better idea than anywhere else how these great obelisks were actually hollowed out of the rock. And it was an extraordinary undertaking. You think they really only had stone tools and copper chisels, which are, you know, not very sharp, not very strong against the granite. And yet, just by sheer labor and sheer sticking at it, they managed to hollow out from the bedrock these extraordinary monuments. And I think it's a testament to, you know, the Egyptians' ingenuity, their hard work, and again, this fact that the Nile allows Egypt to quarry huge blocks of stone and float them easily downriver to build temples and tombs and so forth. So, again, without the Nile, we wouldn't have those great monuments that conjure up Egypt in all its glory.
I think people, when they look at Egypt on a map, they don't sense the scale. You're talking, they would float these things hundreds of miles.
Oh, that's right. It is hundreds and hundreds of miles from the granite quarries to some of the major temples. But of course, that's where the Nile again comes in, because it unites every part of Egypt. And as long as you can get your stone blocks to the riverbank and onto a barge, the river will take you where you want to go.
Yeah. Well, as you head up to the north and downriver on the Nile, eventually you will come to places like Thebes and Luxor. And, of course, those are very famous, you know, the Valley of the Kings and the great temple there at Luxor. But what are some of the other sites that we should know about in this particular part of Egypt, the lower part of Egypt, as it would be geographically?
Well, there are some remarkable sites that are very little known a little bit off the usual tourist track. I think one of my favorites is a site called Abydos, and it had huge religious significance in ancient Egypt. It was a big pilgrimage site throughout the time of the pharaohs, and there is a remarkable temple there still, which has reliefs, decoration on the walls with the freshest of colors. They look as though they've literally just been painted yesterday, and in fact, they're over 3,000 years old. And it's also a site that has a special spiritual quality to it. It receives very few visitors, but it's an absolute wonder. And to my mind, it's one of the most magical places in the whole of Egypt.
My guest today is Toby Wilkinson, an Egyptologist and the author of The Nile, A Journey Downriver Through Egypt's Past and Present. It's published by Knopf. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, as you travel up the river or down the river, it's always weird because we expect rivers to go south and this one goes north.
That's right.
But as you head down river, eventually you come to Nag Hammadi, which is famous for a completely different reason other than ruins and the old ancient Egypt civilization. It goes back to the other role that Egypt had in our learning, which is this repository of information. Of course, we think of the great library at Alexandria, but also at Nag Hammadi.
That's right. It's easy to forget these days when, of course, Egypt is an Islamic country, but for several hundred years, it was a Christian country. Between the departure of the Romans and the conquest of the Arabs, it was a Christian country, and it was one of the cradles of early Christianity. And this remarkable discovery was made back in the 1940s in Nag Hammadi. A whole series of documents which had been buried in a jar, and they turned out to be very rare texts from the early days of the Christian church, which depart in quite some striking ways from what has now come down to us as the sort of canonical gospels. And they give a very different impression of life in an early Christian community. And it's been an extraordinary voyage of discovery for scholars to read these texts and to learn more about the early church and how actually it was very different from what we might think of today.
You also, in the course of telling us the story of this river and the story of the area surrounding this river, you tell us about several notable people, including Lucy Lady Duff Gordon, who is this incredible 19th century figure who really documented what was happening in Egypt. She traveled. She lived at the Luxor Temple for a number of years. Really fascinating woman. Was this someone you were very familiar with?
Not at all. In fact, I had heard about her, but until I started writing this book and doing the research for it, I'd never really read her entire story. And you're right, it's remarkable. This is a society hostess in London who's very well known for throwing parties, for her wit and wisdom. And like so many of her time, she could have just been content with that. But she was unwell, and one of the remedies, if you could afford it, if you were unwell, was to go to a warmer country. And so she took off to Egypt. And she, I think, felt a particularly strong bond with the Egyptian people, and she saw them being persecuted. And she wrote about this in a very brave way. I mean, she was a lone Western woman, probably the only Western woman living in Egypt full-time. She was very vulnerable, but she stood up for the ordinary people against their oppressors, against their rulers, at great risk to her own life. And in doing so, documented this extraordinary period in Egypt's modern story when it was just emerging from the sort of medieval period into the modern world. A completely remarkable figure.
Now, also another one would be David Roberts. Who was David Roberts?
Well, I think, although people may not know the name, they would recognize his work. He was a watercolor painter from Scotland. And after a very varied career designing theater sets and working in London as well as in Scotland, he decided to go off to Egypt and to the Holy Land. And he produced what I think are still regarded as the quintessential paintings of Egypt, of the Nile, of the temples, and he brought them back, and they became a huge public sensation. Everybody wanted a copy of a David Roberts print, and they're still very popular to this day. And if you, if you look up on a search engine, David Roberts Egypt, you'll see all these iconic views of the Nile, and they still summon up, I think, better than anything else, that sort of majesty and mystery that we associate with Egypt.
You also tell, of course, the story of Howard Carter. For many people, this is sort of the 20th century story of Egypt, the explorer, the anthropologist, the fortune hunter. Of course, he discovers the tomb of Tutankhamun and Tut's curse and all of this. It's become a very romantic figure. What was most interesting about him?
Well, he is the real-life Indiana Jones. He was a very persistent man. He was not an easy man to get on with, and I think this is one of the interesting things. He was very determined, but he made enemies very easily. And I think this is reflected in the end of his life. You know, he was the greatest archaeologist of his generation. He discovered the greatest treasure that's ever been found anywhere in the world, the treasures of Tutankhamun. And yet, he was shunned by his fellow archaeologists. And indeed, when he died, there were barely any tributes to him at all from his peers. So at one time, you have this incredibly successful archaeologist who is also something of a social recluse, and it's a very interesting story.
My guest today is Toby Wilkinson. He is an Egyptologist whose new book details the whole lifeline of the Nile to Egypt over its ancient culture as well as today. The name of the book is The Nile, A Journey Downriver Through Egypt's Past and Present. It's published by Knopf. Well, what are some of the most overlooked sites along the river? Traveling down the whole length, it's a long river in Egypt. It's what, how many hundreds of miles, even just down to Cairo?
Well, from Aswan to Cairo, it's 600 or 700 miles. It is a long way.
So what is some of the most overlooked locations along the river that fascinated you?
Well, I think there are a cluster of locations in the middle part of the Nile Valley, halfway between Luxor and Cairo, if you like. Again, it's not a part of the country that very many visitors are able to explore. There is a remarkable site there, which we call today Tell El Amarna, and it's perhaps most famous because it was the capital city of a king who we call the heretic pharaoh. Akhenaten was his name.
The Sun King.
And he engaged in this extraordinary revolution, overthrowing centuries of religious tradition, of artistic tradition. He invents an entirely new way of showing the world, an entirely new religion. He writes religious poetry, which is some of the earliest hymns that survive. And to cap it all, decides to found a completely new capital city, which is on virgin territory, never before occupied, and so unsullied by the past. And it's almost like sort of turning the clock back to year zero, and he's saying, we're going to start all over again with a brand new way of doing things. And because this was so revolutionary and so unpopular, ultimately, his revolution died with him. This site was then abandoned, and so we have a time capsule of one king's reign, an entire city that dates to just this one king's reign, really abandoned almost overnight. And it provides the most extraordinary insights into daily life, into the lives and livelihood of ordinary people in Egypt. It's really quite an astonishing sight.
Of course, the river comes down to Cairo, rolls down to Cairo, and of course this is an incredible, huge, huge city. What was it about this particular site that made this the center of Egypt? Was there something particular about where Cairo is?
Well, yes, and indeed, even before Cairo was founded by the Arabs, the capital of Egypt had been pretty much in the same place for 3,000 years. And it's simply because it's that point where the river, the single stream of the Nile, splits into a number of streams as it fans out to form the delta and flows into the Mediterranean Sea. So it's a naturally important strategic location from which to govern both the north of the country and the south. But it's a kind of critical transport and communications node. And so it becomes, you know, the obvious site for a capital city. And it's extraordinary to think that the Egyptian capital has been on that same site for 5,000 years.
You know, one of the things I was really struck by, you would think of a great river like the Nile, there would be, and in many places it is, the valley is very wide, but many places along this, even in upper Egypt, you're looking at just a small little valley of green, and literally within sight of the river, the desert is there. That's just
absolutely
amazing.
I mean, the contrast is very stark. In places, the strip of green along the bank of the river is no more than 10 or 20 feet wide, impossibly narrow, you might think, and yet even there, people manage to eke out a living, growing crops and feeding their livestock. And I think that also tells you something about the Egyptian mentality, the fact that you have this extraordinary contrast between the strip of green, the fertile Nile Valley, and this desert either side, which is completely inhospitable. Egyptians have always been very conscious that their world is fragile, that you know, the balance between feast and famine, between the desert and the river, is a very delicate balance. And I think this explains a lot about the Egyptian way of looking at the world and their place in the world. They're conscious that you know, they've had to work hard to create the society and the civilization that they have.
Of course, that fragility is underscored by the political situation in Egypt today. And as you're writing this book, you're watching this whole contemporary history unfold with the Arab Spring, the promise, the failure, and all the setbacks and slow movement forward in Cairo and in Egypt today. It must be a really fascinating to watch, given your sense of history.
It is, and I think it's only by appreciating Egypt's long history that you can begin to make sense of what's happening today. Some of the developments which may seem perplexing when looked at from the outside actually fit into a pattern of history that has repeated itself endlessly over the centuries. And although the future looks very uncertain, I think you can be certain from the pattern of history that the Egyptians always managed pull through somehow, and I think that's, again, it's down to the Nile, because the Nile gives them that confidence that you know, no matter how bad things get, they will always have a source of water for their crops, for their livestock, for themselves, and it provides this great continuity from the past through the present to the future. So although it's a difficult time in Egypt today, I think the Egyptians will, as they always have, triumph.
Well, it's a wonderful book which combines travelogue along with archaeology, anthropology, history, and telling the story of how this river has affected this longest of our civilizations on this planet. From a straight travel perspective, where's your favorite spot along the Nile?
Oh, that's a tough one because there are so many great places. I would have to say where I start the book, Aswan, is one of my favorite places. The cliffs are very steep, and they come straight down to the river's edge. You have extraordinary views across the river, some beautiful islands in the Nile, with some wonderful sights to visit, and it's a very peaceful and special place.
All right. Well, we wish you great success with this book. The name of the book, The Nile. Toby Wilkinson, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Egyptologist Toby Wilkinson speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His new book, The Nile, A Journey Down River Through Egypt's Past and Present, is published by Knopf. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.